at least by the class, becoming experts in projective duality. And I gave a particular projective duality. There's all kinds of other ways to describe a projective duality. We did this parabolic projective duality, which is really popular in computational geometry, and it's particularly useful for us because it realizes this Delaunay-Voronoi duality as a duality, as a projective duality in the lifted space. So today we're going to put this to work. So if you think about the exercises we did, many of the exercises were of the form describe some set of lines by looking at the set of points that they're dual to, or to describe a set of points by looking at the set of lines that they're dual to. And sometimes something which was very simple becomes complex, like for instance, points on a line segment becomes this pencil of lines. But on the other hand, a vertical line segment became a nice slab. It's usually called the slab, it's the region between two parallel lines. And we're going to use this idea to take on a problem where the queries are lines. Technically, there are going to be entire half spaces, but we're going to be bounded by a line. And by duality, we're going to think of them as a point, and that way we're going to be able to represent an entire space of lines instead of a space of points. So here's the real the name of this problem we're going to be talking about. It's called half space range counting. Range counting is something else. I don't know what it is. Range counting. And the input, so we're just going to do this in 2D here. The input is a set of points. And for now, we can say in general position, so no three of them are linear. Won't make a big difference for anything we do today. We'll say the size of P is some number n. So when I talk about n, I'm talking about the number of points in the input. All right, so this is a set of points. And we want to build a data structure that supports the following type of query. We may have a picture going here. So if this is an input, a query is given a half space H. Return the number of points in H, the number of input points in H. Is to be able to do these queries in order log n time. And we're willing to pay O of n squared space. Now we won't get all of this today, because the actual running time is going to depend on a more general searching data structure, which we'll cover. But for now, we're going to look at what the heck the data structure we're going to build is, and why it comes out to be n squared space. And the particular challenge for today is the pre-processing time, which is the building of the data structure. So we want n squared time for pre-processing. Hopefully this is familiar to many or all of you, this idea that in data structure problems, there's some amount of space and time that goes into building the overall data structure, and then there's some amount of time for the queries. And often there's trade-offs between, say, the amount of space you use or the amount of pre-processing you do, and the amount of query time that takes. So let's just continue the picture. If I have this set of points and I ask for particular half space, well, how am I going to specify a half space? I can give the equation for it. Really, it's going to be a line and a slide. So for now, let's say I'm just asking for, I'll give you the equation of a line and ask for all points below that line. Or maybe I'll give you the line, give it to a query, use a line, and say all points above it. And I just want to count how many there are. If we rewind this, or we'll say project this down and think about, instead of the 2D version of this problem, there's the 1D version of this problem, which I think you know pretty well. That's just points on a line now. And the query as a half space is what? It's like some interval like this, which goes off to infinity or negative infinity in one direction, and you just want to know how many points are in there. And this is the kind of problem you spend most of an undergraduate algorithms class on. This is a classic one-dimensional problem, because how do you solve this? You just sort the points. And then, for instance, a query, you might put in, if you put the points into a binary search tree, what is the, and the points know their rank. For instance, this point knows it's 1, this point knows it's 2, 3, 4, etc. This is the so-called predecessor search problem. So given a set of numbers, and given a query, you want to find the largest number less than that query number. So 1D. And you can solve this with a nice binary search tree and predecessor search. There's some nice things that we can draw from this. We can see that if I pick a division anywhere between 3 and 4, the answer is always going to be 3. So if I took this half space, this, I'm calling them half spaces, and they are half spaces, they're one-dimensional half spaces. I take this one, or I take this one, or this one. There's this whole region where wherever I stick the endpoint, I'm going to get the same answer. And so there's only these discrete points where there's a change, and those points are defined exactly by the input points. The same phenomenon is actually true here. If I have this particular line, obviously I can wiggle this line, assuming this general position, I can always wiggle it, in fact. I can have some nearby lines which all have the same set of points below them. Now, when I say nearby lines, first that might surprise you, or maybe you didn't think about it. Like, when I draw a picture, clearly two lines are close, but how do you really put a metric on a space of lines? One pretty natural way of doing it is to take the dual points and look at the distance between the dual points. It's not canonical, but it gives a metric, and it turns out to be exactly the right metric. Right. So what does this problem look like in the dual? So for 2D, the dual problem looks like this. The set of points, so P becomes a set of lines. Let's call it L. L is equal to P star. So I have this set of lines now. I had points, now I have lines. And what's true? Well, I know that when I did this dualizing, I'm going to preserve all the incidence relations. So when I have these queries came in, these lines, if one of these lines is going to dualize to a point, and if I ask for the number of points below this line, it's the same as asking the number of lines below this point. So if I walk straight down, how many lines do I hit? Probably this one way down low. Probably. Okay, that's the incidence preservation, and it's also the fact that the particular duality we chose preserves above and below. That's nice. Let's see, what is this collection of lines and how are we going to store it? We're going to say that the arrangement of a set of lines, or this is an arrangement of lines, so this arrangement of the set of lines L is the polyhedral complex that it induces on the plane. So each of these lines break the plane up into these nice polyhedra, and these polyhedra glue together along edges, and the edges end at vertices or at infinity. These are nice, this is a nice polyhedral complex. So it is the polyhedral complex decomposing the plane such that, I guess the most important property here is that the union of the edges in the complex A of L is equal to the union of the lines in L. This is an E and this is an L. So it, a particular polyhedron, let's say a two-dimensional polyhedron in the arrangement might be this one right here. That's a two-dimensional polyhedron. It has what? 1, 2, 3, 4 edges. And there are other polyhedra. So this polygon, and I'm kind of opting to call them polyhedra because remember our definition of polyhedra allowed for these unbounded polyhedra as well. It just had to be what to be a polyhedron? Someone.
Intersection of half spaces.
Yeah, an intersection of a finite set of half spaces. And in this case, the half spaces are just either being on one side of the line or the other side of the line. So each line finds two half spaces. And each of these polyhedra is either above or below some set of half spaces. So it's defined, for instance, this particular one is all the points which happen to be both at this happen to be at the same time above this line, below this line, above this line, and below this line. These are the only points that satisfy all those conditions. If I swapped one of those conditions and said I have to be above, say, this one, and I guess in this case we're also below this line, we would get this neighboring polygon. Right. And you should check that this really is a polyhedral complex. What was the rule? It should have to be that two polyhedra, if they intersect, they intersect at a common face. And a face was a polyhedron of one dimension low, of a lower dimension on the boundary. So this is the arrangement. How many, let's check the combinatorics here. We've got n lines. How many cells could there be? That's pretty tricky. Here's an easier question. How many vertices can there be?
Actually, if we add a new line, it has to be maximum cut n minus 1 previous lines. Can we go with induction?
So what are you proposing for an upper bound of the number of vertices?
N squared.
Like order n squared.
Yeah.
Maybe n choose 2. And that makes sense because every vertex is just the intersection of two of these lines. So you can get at most one vertex for every pair of lines. So there's at most n choose 2. Vertices. Okay, this is also a planar graph. So since it's a planar graph by Euler's formula, we know that the number of faces is also within the constant of this number of vertices. So we're looking at a total complexity here as order n squared, which is good because that was our target. we said we're going to allow ourselves a quadratic amount of space. And since we're going to build something that's quadratically sized, we certainly expect to spend at least quadratic time. Otherwise, we wouldn't even be able to write down the data structure in less time. And so one way to view this is that given that our goal is to construct an arrangement, and what we really will do is build a half-edge data structure which represents this arrangement. We're doing it in essentially linear time, linear in the size of the object we're building. So at first you said, oh, quadratic algorithms. You should think of it as a linear time algorithm for a quadratic size object. Let's check a couple hopefully obvious facts that the cells or the cells of this complex here are convex. We know that because each of these really is the intersection of a finite set of half spaces, which is the intersection of convex sets is convex. And
all unbounded cells are also convex?
Yes. Because half space is convex, and the unbounded cells are still the intersection of a finite set of half spaces. Intersection of convex sets is convex. You can also check that analytically. Good, and now, what is our query going to look like? Well, the query is going to be a line which we will dualize to a point, and the goal is to find which cell in this arrangement contains this point. Once we know which cell it is, we can pre-compute for every cell the number of lines below it. Now, this is something that you need to be careful to, or it may not be obvious, but if I get any query inside this cell, I'm going to get the same answer. I'm going to get exactly the same set of lines that are below it. It's just like in 1D, where if I query in any one of these intervals broken up by the points, I will get not only the same number, but the exact same set of points below it. Is that obvious, or do you want to think about this? What defines the cell is just which lines is above and which is below. So once you fix, if there were two points in here where they disagreed about whether or not they were above or below a particular line, well then that line would have to pass between them, and they would not be in the same cell. So if these two disagreed about this line, he said, we're above this line. He says, no, we're below this line. Well, it turns out you're not in the same cell. Okay, so the problem that we're really reducing this to, the query part, which I said we're not going to get to today, but the query part reduces to the problem of finding, given a planar straight line graph, possibly with some points even at infinity, given that such a planar straight line graph, find in a query point, find the face that contains the query point.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Do we have any degenerate case of the lines in this?
So if we assume this general position about the points, that's going to correspond to something about general position of the lines. So if I say that there are no three points collinear, that means there's no three lines intersecting at a point. Mm-hmm. So in that case, I believe, what do we get exactly in these two vertices? What do you think? Parallel lines, yes. I suppose we could have parallel lines. But actually, parallel lines are okay. Because we are going to have to deal with infinity here. And if those parallel lines came from lines that were arranged vertically here, and so if we rotate the space, or perturb it by some small amount, they're no longer parallel. because...
So you solved the problem with perturbation?
Well, I'm solving it by assuming it away over here. So one interpretation of this general position, often I give specific explanations, like no three collinear or no four co-circular. But really what I mean is that it's things that are general really means in the sense of being generic. And so if it's any property that doesn't stand up to a small perturbation is not going to be generic. So I have actively avoided going into a more detailed description of what I mean by general position, but one way to think about it is it excludes a set of inputs, a collection of inputs of measure zero. So the set of inputs that I'm assuming don't exist have measure zero within the set of all inputs. That's the measure theoretic viewpoint. Whether or not that's practical, it's not always, it depends on the case. Not always. Okay, so we took some points, we dualized them, now we took our query, which was a line, which became a point, and we're going to find it. And here's my claim, and this is one that we're going to prove right today, is that it is possible to build a data structure over a planar straight line graph such that, I'll say of size the planar straight line graph with k vertices. Such that finding the cell containing a query point takes only order log k time. We have to put it on hold. Well, let's think about what it means in saying that. I give you any planar straight line graph that decomposes the plane, or some really the entire plane, into cells, and I can find which cell contains a particular point and time that's logarithmic in the number of vertices. What does it mean for us? Well, we know that the number of vertices is at most quadratic. So k is like, say, O of n squared. Log of n squared is log n. Log of n squared is 2 log n, so it's O of log n. So that's going to give us our log n query time. Okay. It gives us that time, assuming we can pre-process it and actually build it. And what else do we have to do after we build it? We have to store in each space how many, what the answer is going to be, like what the actual count will be. So how do we build this arrangement? We're going to use an algorithmic paradigm that we've seen before. We're going to do an incremental construction. So we're going to order the lines, and we're going to add the lines one at a time. And after we've added I lines, we'll have the arrangement produced by the first I lines. Unlike with the Dolan triangulation, we won't need to use any randomization to get the desired running time. But if at first sight, it should still be a little surprising. I think it's still a little surprising that the running time will be linear. So let me draw an example. If you start with, say, these lines, the incremental algorithm says, I suppose I have not just these lines, but a plain straight line graph for these lines. And to deal with infinity, here's one way to think about the infinity, is that there is a line at infinity, and we'll just draw it as a circle. And the circle is big enough that it contains all of the intersection points. Right? Because if there's two lines that intersect, then this circle has to be even farther out. So if we draw a circle that's big enough to contain all the intersection points, we might as well call that the line of points at infinity. And a couple things are true. One is that if I go around the circle, every line cuts through twice. And as I go around, there's this, as I go around the circle, this really is ordered by the slope of these lines. That once you're far enough away, this is just telling me that this one is sloped. As I go around here, the slope is increasing, increasing, increasing until I get to the midpoint. And now, these intersection points here, of course, I've already counted because every line will intersect once on one side and once on the other. Okay, so if I wanted to order the lines by their slope, I could actually just look at how they intersect this sufficiently large circle. The other way this is sometimes done is you imagine it's a sufficiently large box, and you make it so big that all of the lines cut through the box on one side, on the left side and come out on the right side, again assuming no vertical lines. But we don't really expect any vertical lines. Why not? Yeah, because somehow they had to give us a point at infinity, which does, it's much harder to specify an input. Okay, so this is how we're going to think about infinity. Now all these cells are nice and bounded. We've added one extra line. And so now you can really think about these as compact cells, if you like. I find that for many people that makes intuition a little easier. Alright, so in the incremental construction, what will we do? At time I, we're going to add the ith line. So that's going to be what pi star. And how do we do it? Well, we look at where it comes in at infinity. So it has some slope for this line, and the slope is somewhere in here. And that will tell us where it cuts in first. And it cuts right through. And since we have once we have this outer line, that's just sorting the points by their slope. We find this is really just solving the 1D case. Right, we find the slope, those are the largest slope, like the smallest slope larger than the slope of our new point here. This is the I star. And that tells us where we cut in at infinity, and now that puts us in a cell. And we want to find where we're going to leave that cell. Because before we had one cell here, and we want to cut it into two pieces with this line. So what we'll actually do is, since we know the edge, we're going to walk around here. We can walk in either direction. I'm going to do it counterclockwise because that's the convention we've been using. So I walk in counterclockwise order around this cell until the edge that I traverse crosses the line that I'm inserting. And once that happens, I know that that's the edge, that's the line that pi star crosses to leave. So I get a point here, and what will I do? I'll take the twin of this half edge, I'll jump over here, and I'll walk around again until I cross again. Once I cross, that tells me that this line breaks out at this endpoint. The twin, around. Oops, this one goes again. Intersection. Okay, so by doing this simple walk, I find all of the intersection points of pi star with the existing line. And I found them, in fact, in order how they occur along the line from left to right. As we are doing this, in order to update the half-edge data structure, we would actually add, once we find this vertex, we would take this edge, split it into two edges. So that's two half-edges becomes four half-edges. And we would add in some new half-edges to break apart this polygon into two pieces, the top and the bottom. Okay, and those kinds of, that's very, very similar to the homework problems. Although homework problems, you're limited to just triangulations. Here, you're just taking a polygon and you want to add a new edge across the polygon. So I trust that you can do that part. But the tricky thing was just to find even what are these intersections and what order they occur. Well, this all works, but what's the running time? You'd like to say that inserting one line took at most linear time. It kind of takes at least linear time, because it intersects every other line. So you expect to pay at least linear time. But how do you bound the time it took? Because I have to walk all the way around the face. Now, in this case, it was pretty simple. I never had to walk very far. When I crossed this edge once, when I crossed here, I only had to take, two steps, and I was crossing again. When I flipped over, I only took one step, and I was crossing again. But that's not necessarily the case. Yeah?
Question. So is it not the case that it is going to the new line that you added, pi, that is going to intersect exactly n times, because we are extending it to the infinity?
Yes.
Exactly cross
n minus 1, yeah. Or I minus, in this case, I minus 1.
I minus 1, yeah.
So this is a kind of what we might call a walking algorithm. So whenever you have a finger on a graph and you go from edge to edge through a graph, it's usually called a walk in a graph. Here we're walking through this planar straight line graph, and we're doing it in a smart way, checking so that every time we cross our line, we take the twin, and we walk again around each face. We take the twin every time we cross, and that gives us all the intersections. What we're walking through here is called the zone of so the zone of the line. In arrangement, the line L in arrangement is the subcomplex, so the set of polyhedra that the line passes through. This example maybe doesn't have enough lines to be all that interesting, but it contains this polyhedron, this one, and this one. So you took the whole arrangement, and you throw out these polyhedra that don't intersect the line, and the zone. And if you ask for what is the running time of this insertion, it could be, something like the total number of edges in the zone. Inserting pi star takes time proportional to the number of edges in the zone. In the zone of pi star with respect to p1 to pi minus 1. Let me show you a couple things that don't work, that are just not true. You might hope, for instance, that when I'm walking along a, when I'm walking through the zone here, since I'm walking, these edges are sub, they're intervals of lines, you might hope that you only touch a particular line once in the whole walk. But that's not true, so here's a bad example. Here's the X star. So here's an example with a lot more lines. And if you look at the zone here, how's this walk going to work? It's going to come around here like this. Essentially hits, walks around like this, switches over, walks around like this, switches over, walks around like this. So, in fact, there are many times, order n times, where I'm walking along just one line. So, as I look at, as I break this walk into pieces, and I ask which line am I on at any given time, I might revisit the same line a linear number of times. Which makes you think, well, maybe it could be n squared. Could there really be n squared total edges? Does anyone have a guess for how we can found this? So this, as an isolated geometric fact, is interesting enough to get its own name, something called the zone theorem. And here's the statement. It says, given n lines, L, and the line L, little l, let's say, is not one of the original lines. Turns out it doesn't matter so much. Given this, this is statement stated different ways, but let's say it this way, the number of edges in zone L, the arrangement of L, is we'll get an exact number here. Right, and this is true even if we allow some kinds of degeneracy, all kinds of degeneracy. Any questions? So here's the proof. The proof of the zone theorem. We're going to do induction on M. Right. The first thing, without loss of generality, let's assume that this line L that we're looking at is horizontal. The reason I say without loss of generality is because if we rotate everything, we don't change anything about the number of lines intersecting. We just translate it, or really just rotate the entire arrangement. So we can rotate the whole arrangement so this line L happens to be horizontal, and that's just going to be useful for us so that we can talk about what we're going to call the left bounding edges and the right bounding edges of a polyhedron. So without loss of generality, L is horizontal. Which is harder than drawing it anyway. For a polygon, or a 2D polyhedron, we're going to say it has left edges and right edges, and here's the difference. The left edges have the polygon to the right of them, and the right edges have the polygon to the left. Okay, it's safe to make this distinction because if they were exactly horizontal, they would be collinear with L, which, at least for now, let's say it doesn't happen. If they were horizontal, they certainly wouldn't intersect L unless they were equal to L. So we have left edges and right edges. And I claim that it's going to suffice to give a proof that the number of left edges is small. And the reason is that if I can prove to you that the number of left edges is small, then I can just flip the world upside down, or left to right, look at it in the mirror, so to speak, and apply the same proof, and it'll also imply that the number of right edges is small. And this is a critical trick. Once you do this, the proof actually becomes quite easy. Because what's our inductive hypothesis going to be? By induction, we're going to assume that the number of left edges is at most 3m. That's the number of left edges in the zone. So that's our hypothesis. At most 3m edges, left edges in the zone. So now we want to solve this for the case where we have n plus one lines. What do? We take the line which is the last one that L intersects. So there are all kinds of lines here. There's one that has the last intersection going from left to right. Okay, so let's call that's a particular line here. If we were to, let's call it Lm plus 1. So we'll pretend that was the last one we added. Now, of course, the inductive argument is independent of the incremental algorithm, but we can think about inductive arguments as kinds of incremental algorithms, where the inductive hypothesis is the, often rephrased as what, an algorithmic invariant in doing incremental algorithm. So in this case, we imagine that this was the last one we added. If we removed that one, by induction, we would have m lines, and we'd have only 3m left edges. So we ask, what happens when we added this one back in? What happens to the set of left edges? Well, in this case, there was a... there was a polygon here. That had, for this polygon, this bit of edge was a right edge, so it doesn't matter. But we had This one right here from, it's nice and dark. From here to here, we had a left edge that now is two left edges because it got split by our new line. There's this one and this one. So we had one and now we have two, so we've increased by one over here. We had another left edge that was from here to here that also got split. We had one and now we have two there, so that's another plus one. And then there's this line itself is the left edge of this polyhedron, plus one. So if that's all there is, then we're done because we've inserting this one new line added only three new left edges. By induction, we had only 3m before. So 3m plus 3 is 3 times m plus 1. So the inductive hypothesis holds for m plus 1 as well. And we're done. So you have to look at this long enough and think about this enough to see why these are the only changes that happen. Like if you can't see that, then that's one way you can check to see if you understand. Okay. So why is it the case? Why can't it be the case that there's some other new left edges? So the only new edges we have are ones that are either part of the new line or they were split by the new line. So the only ones that can be part of the new line and intersect the line segment is just this one. Because everything else to the left here would have to be a polyhedron that intersects the line. But we chose this to be the rightmost intersection. So there's no other intersections over here to the right of this point. So this is the only line of that first type, the new edge, which is actually a sub-edge of the new line that we get out of here. The other ones we have to look at is for every one of these intersections, we created a new edge. Let's look at some other intersection that might have happened. So it's true that we create new, there are new edges here, but any one of these edges, in order for it to be the left edge in the zone, it has to be the left edge in a polyhedron that intersects this line. But there is only one polyhedron that intersects this line. It was the polyhedron that contains this rightmost segment. And since we chose this to be the rightmost point, the rightmost intersection point, none of these other polyhedra can intersect the line. Right? So none of those polyhedra, if they don't intersect the line, they're not in the zone. So even though we may introduce right edges for some other polyhedron, none of those polyhedra are in the zone. And we're only counting for this one line. Now, the reason this is partly a little bit confusing because we look at the zone of this line to understand the incremental algorithm for inserting this line. And we prove it by looking at a different line and asking about an incremental construction of the zone for that line. You need to be able to sort these two things out. We do care about just the zone of L, and we look at how the zone of L changes when we added the last line. And it introduces almost three new edges. So there's a total, 3m total left edges. And since the argument doesn't really depend on left and right, we can do it on the other side as well. There's three, at most 3m right edges. And so there's almost 6m total edges. So we can write this even as. Questions? All right, now once we have the zone there, now that the running time of the incremental algorithm is only is O of m squared. Because the length of the walk, was just the length of the size of the zone, was at most we walk around every edge in the zone. In fact, we might skip some if we happen to take the short side instead of the long side. We get lucky. But it's at most the length of the zone, and the length of the zone is at most order I for the I point. So the total running time, is just the sum. I equals 1 to n of I, which is O of n squared. So there's our quadratic running time, except that we're not really done. We built a planar straight line graph that represents the arrangement, but what we don't yet have is the answers to our queries stored in the cells. So let's draw on another arrangement. What we're going to do is, in each cell, we're going to store the number of lines below that cell. There's some set here on the bottom, which we've been calling the lower envelope of a set of lines, where there are no lines below any of these points. This is the lower envelope. And so if we started here, we know that there's a zero here. You can find, I claim that you can find this one just by looking at, finding the line with the longest slope, and finding, with the largest slope, and that's going to give you this first edge in the, of this lower envelope. And we can now just walk through the dual . So when I say walk through the dual, I'm thinking about now, rather than walking along the edges and vertices, I'm walking from face to face. And I can go from one face to an adjacent face where they're adjacent if they share an edge. This is exactly the dual. And I know that if this one is going to be zero, every one of its neighbors is going to be one. Because I was below this line, now I'm above this line, and this is the only line that I'm above if I'm in this cell. Now, if I go up one more line, I'll hit 2. This one will be 2. It doesn't matter which order I do it in. So I can apply whatever your favorite graph search algorithm is, graph first search. As long as you're always going from below a line to above a line, then the number of lines below you will increase by 1. And so this is just a simple graph search to populate the cells with numbers now. And these numbers represent the output, right? The counts, the range counts, for any query that lands in that cell. So what's the running time for a graph search? This is a graph with what? Order n squared. The graph is the dual. So there's a vertex and a graph for every face. And you said what? N squared?
order of number of vertices plus number of edges.
Right, and by Euler's formula, we know that those are going to be within a constant factor of each other, and the number of faces here is within a constant factor of the number of vertices, which is order n squared. So the whole total running time here again is n squared to do a search and populate the query answers. So what would be the more naive approach is to actually ask for each one of these to try to check. But since there's order n squared cells, you don't want to check in brute force which lines are below each one, because that would be n cubed now. For every n, each of the n, order n squared cells, you've got to check and count for each one. Each one can take order n time. In fact, they'd have to, because a lot of these counts start to get to be order n. Once you're above, say, a constant fraction of the lines, every one of those counts, if you had to count it manually for each cell, would take linear time. So this cute observation that you can just walk through the arrangement now, using all the kind of power of these half-edge data structure to walk not just through the graph, but through its dual, and just populate those numbers without explicitly counting them. You can do that. All right, so that's, that gives us how to count the faces. So, for half space range counting, we dualize. And now I can't stress enough the importance of this change in perspective, that this convex polygon here actually represents a whole collection of lines that all separate the points at the same way. Is that clear? That any one of the points in this convex polygon dualizes to a line, that when you draw that line to the original input point set, it splits them the same way. It has the same points above and the same points below for any two lines you're choosing here. So I don't think our brains are wired to think about sets of lines. But sets of points, that you can get our head around. And the fact that it's a nice convex set is even nicer. Okay, so dualizing in this case really gives us a better perspective. And now, Once we dualize a set of points to a set of lines, we actually have to build the arrangement. And that arrangement was just a half-edge data structure. It was just a planar straight line graph. And we do this in n squared time. We assign the counts to the cells. That's also total n squared time. Again, think of both of these as linear in the output size, linear in the graph size. And of course, the missing piece is we're going to use what's called a history tag. And this is what we're going to do, I think, next time to handle the queries. And the goal here is just going to be find the cell, given a point of time. I've got plenty of time, so I'm going to start explaining that the history tag as a data structure for finding points in arrangements, or actually finding points in any planar straight line graph. And the nice thing about it is that you've already kind of seen it, because it's one way to interpret the point location we already did for the line triangulation.
Actually, you reduce the half space range counting to point location problem?
Yes. Yeah, so it's sometimes called a point location problem. Yeah. When you have some collection of objects, in its most general form, point location is you have a collection of objects, you have queries which are points, you want to find the object that contains the point. And if you recall, with Boolean triangulation, for incremental Boolean triangulation, we had to find, for each new point that we were going to add, the point location part was to find the triangle that contains that point. So, at time I, find the triangle containing pi. Okay, and we took what might be called an eager approach. And the eager approach is that we take all the points we haven't inserted yet, and we figure out what the answer will be, assuming that they're going to be the next one, right? Because there wasn't just for a given triangulation, there's some large, at first, of course, there's almost all the points, but there's always some collection of points we haven't inserted yet. And what we did was, every time we updated the triangulation, we figured out what triangle they were going to be in. So we actively moved them from a triangle that was destroyed to a new triangle that was formed. And if you take this in time, let's see if I can draw this. If you imagine at the beginning there was just one triangle, and we use the vertical axis here to be time. And as time progresses here, later time, I've got more points. Okay, so here's 3 points, 4 points, 5 points. And these points do line up, are supposed to line up vertically here. So this is this one, this is all the same point. That's just three different points in time, three different moments in time, three different times through the main loop of the algorithm. And in here, there were some points that we were storing. And those points, as we go from here to here, we had to move, well, this point gets moved into, it was in the big triangle, and now it's in this triangle. And actually, this point as well was in this triangle that goes into a new triangle, and this one ends up in a different triangle. And at each step, we rearrange all the points. You can imagine, if we call this the eager version, the lazy version, which oddly enough takes more work, the lazy version would just be to remember that when I destroyed this triangle, I created both of these triangles. So I'm going to draw this in red. So I say, well, here's it for this triangle. So like this. It could go to this triangle or to this triangle. And when I destroyed this triangle, maybe it could have gone to several of them. Maybe it could have gone to this one or this one. It could be that this triangle intersected, in fact, all of them. And this triangle maybe intersected just these two. And what I get is a hierarchy of triangulations. It also has a graph on it, if I remember all the triangles throughout all time. And if you recall, at least in the Delaunay case, we proved that there were only a linear number seen throughout the whole course of the algorithm. And now, I haven't actively kept track of where the points are. But if I want to find a point, I know exactly what tests make. If I want to find this point all the way down here, well, I check. I know it started in this triangle, and I just have to check. I'm missing an edge here. Right? I have to check among its children which of those two triangles did it lie in. And then I check again of the children here, which of those did it lie in. And you should feel, you should recognize these comparisons. They're exactly the same comparisons we were doing actively in the eager version that we presented in class. But now I've just kept around this data structure so that I can do them after the fact. So for the line triangulation, one is not better than the other, except, well, maybe the one I presented in class is better. However, in the case of the line triangulation, it's a little bit special because I gave you all the points up front. You could do it in an eager way because you already knew what the points were. I gave you n points, and I said keep track of these n points as you build this structure. Now we're going to have problems where you build some structure, and then I need you to locate points which were not among the original points. So if I need you to keep around enough data structure, for example, to find an arbitrary point in a Dohany triangulation, you would keep around this graph, you would keep around all the triangles throughout the construction, and this ordering of who destroyed whom. And this is called the history DAG. So you may recall a DAG is a directed acyclic graph. The way I've drawn it, it's just directed down. And it's acyclic because you never go up. There's no cycles. And it's called the history DAG because it actually tracks the history of a construction. Now, with the Dohany triangulation, we had a specific case. We actually built, we had a specific decomposition. And because we had an incremental algorithm, we had this whole history laid out for us. We knew what the triangulation on 3 points was, what on 4, what on 5. In the case where just given an arbitrary planar straight line graph, I don't necessarily have that whole history. In the case of arrangements, maybe I know, maybe I try to do it by the incremental construction. Turns out that might not be the best choice. But we're going to actually construct, show how to build such a history DAG on an arbitrary planar straight line graph. So we won't, instead of doing it now, let me give you one other nice problem that you can solve if you can do this kind of point location problem, which we'll call a point location in a PSLG. Given a PSLG, build the data structure, let's just say with n vertices. Answers in log n time which cell contains a given n input point, the query point. Cell or paper, which sometimes called as faces. Okay, so given this problem, given a solution to this problem, you can do things like the nearest neighbor problem. So in the nearest neighbor problem, the input is n points. Let's keep it in the plane for now. You're given n points, and the query is a new point. And the answer is, or the output, is the point of P that's closest to the query. start saying that now you can do the point location or nearest neighbor search in the plane in log n time. Does anyone know how you do this?
Using more than n time?
Yeah, this is just, the answer is you just do point location on the Voronoi diagram. So this is point location on the Voronoi diagram. So remember, the Voronoi diagram really does decompose our the plane into pieces so we've got all have the same nearest neighbor. And so if you take that plane straight line graph, which is the Voronoi diagram, it has linear complexity. You find which cell you're in, a particular query point in log n time, that tells you the nearest neighbor. So this is a pretty general problem. We kind of came at it from the other side for doing half space range counting. We've seen a special case of the solution for Dolan triangulation, and we can at least check this that it does give a solution to this nearest neighbor problem. So it's a pretty important problem, and we'll talk about a solution to that problem. Any questions?
So using this technique, the nearest neighbor can be solved in log n time?
Yes.
But it will take space of n squared?
No. N squared was the space to store the arrangement. But to store the Voronoi diagram, the Voronoi diagram has linear size. So it's a linear size data structure that takes log n time.
So you would just say this problem of nearest neighbor can be solved in log n time?
In the plane.
You mean if it's a two-dimensional case?
Yeah. It's surprising, but once you jump up to 3D, this problem gets, all the solutions are polynomial, not